All right, so yesterday Larry covered quite a few topics. I actually want to go back, and a lot of my presentation I think will be overlapping with his. I'd like to first start out by reviewing some facts about the visual system. So I think yesterday Larry introduced you to the concept of the receptive field. He told you how things like the spike-triggered average or reverse correlation can be used to make a model of a receptive field using linear systems analysis. And then he told you about simple and complex cells in primary visual cortex. So he talked about V1, simple, and complex cells. All right, so V1 is short for primary visual cortex. Now, historically, even before people studied simple and complex cells in primary visual cortex, they studied earlier stations in visual processing. So they studied the retina and the lateral geniculate nucleus of the thalamus. And so you might ask, what kinds of receptive fields are actually found in these areas? So in both of these areas, the typical thing that you see is a center surround organization. So if you were to model the receptive fields of these cells with some kind of linear filter, what you would find is some kind of Mexican hat shape. I can only draw one spatial dimension here and the amplitude of the filter function right here. But typically in the middle you'll find, say, some center which likes to have light stimuli and a surround which likes to have dark stimuli. Or this would be a so-called on-center cell. And sometimes there are off-center cells which are reversed. So they like to have dark in the center and light in the surround. So there's an antagonistic organization. The center and the surround do have opposite effects on the activity of this cell. So there's no better way to appreciate this than to actually see, or get close to seeing, a real experiment. How many of you have actually seen a neurophysiology experiment? All right, so I'm not going to really show you a whole experiment, but I'll show you something which comes from the laboratory of David Hubel. It was copied from some kind of Super 8 old-fashioned movie to a video and then finally digitized. Is there a volume here? You guys hear this? Okay, so the electrical signals from this neuron are being amplified, and they're being fed to a loudspeaker, so the experimenters can actually hear the signals from the neuron with their own ears. And so typically what happens in one of these penetrations, you stick an electrode in the brain, it's going in blind, basically, and you just hear, you hear noise. But every now and then, the tip of the electrode comes very close to a single neuron, and you start to hear the impulses of a single neuron like this. So let's just start it over again. Well, okay. Okay. On the spot,
only taste in the bottom. And that's if you have this kind of problem, that's what happens. Perfectly symmetric. What we're taking this for. This is very different from that,
which Larry told you about yesterday, which has orientation and selectivity.
Let me think of another example.
Thank you.
I want them to listen to the video.
Ah,
that's the point.
That's the point.
Yeah, that's the point.
Sorry.
All right, so that's how they discovered actually the phenomenon of orientation selectivity. So you get the basic talked about IT. So in IT, there are the so-called face cells. So you can see that the selectivity to features in the earlier areas of the visual system is very simple, right? Either responding to spots, responding to bars. But the idea of the way that many physiologists think about the visual system is that as you move on to higher and higher levels in the visual system, the selectivity to features becomes more and more complex. And IT is the best example of that complexity because there are some cells which seem to respond selectively to faces and not to other kinds of objects. So there's this hierarchy, this gradation of feature selectivity. And at the same time, there is invariance. So I showed you one kind of invariance here, which was the complex cell. Right, so I should just back up. So what's difficult about vision, and what's difficult about perception in general? So it's really this dichotomy of selectivity and invariance. Right? Vision, actually, nobody, if you talk with the average layperson, nobody would actually think that vision is complicated, right? Because anybody can see. Naively, we think that chess is much more difficult than vision, because anybody can see, but not anybody can play chess. But computer scientists have found the opposite. They have computers now which beat the best human at chess, and yet no computer can equal the performance of a human at vision. So nobody really knows how to solve this problem yet. Why is vision so hard? It seems very easy to us, obviously, because our brains are extremely adapted to it. Right? Over millions of years of evolution, whatever, we became very good at vision. It's difficult. Vision is difficult because of the variability of images. Right? One object which always looks the same to us, if we don't really think about it. If you look at it at the pixel level, that object produces extremely different images every time you look at it. So, for example, my head, as I'm moving around in front of you, and I'm changing the orientation of my face and so on, if you took a digital camera and took pictures of that face, and you tried to compare those pictures at a pixel by pixel level, none of those pixels would be the same, right, if you tried to line them up. So vision is actually very difficult, and it's because you have to be very selective to certain differences, right? In order to distinguish between different people, you have to be very selective about differences in their facial features. And yet you have to throw out a huge amount of information about pose and lighting and so on and so forth. So there's two acts. So you have to throw out information and be very sensitive to information at the same time. That's selectivity and invariance, right? So simple and complex cells are interesting because they already have this dichotomy there, right? Simple cells, the remarkable aspect of simple cells is orientation selectivity. And the remarkable aspect of complex cells is that they throw out the phase of the gradient. So they throw out some position information, right? So physiologists like to think that this simple cell and complex cell idea of becoming selective to something and then throwing out something else, this might be extended throughout all the stages of the visual pathways. So ultimately, when you look at an area like IT, a cell in IT might be very selective for faces, and yet if you move that face around, if you move that face around, or you even change its scale, let's say the face expands by twice its size or three times its size as a person walks to you, there's no change or very little change in the response of those neurons. All right, so I guess I'm trying to give you some idea as to why we should care. Like, I think Larry gave a talk yesterday. He showed you some neural network models and tried to explain how simple cell feature selectivity arises, and how complex. What's that?
Are you saying individual neurons are connected to faces?
Well, okay. So it's not to the level necessarily where one neuron would only respond to the face of one person. But the point is, if you show that neuron face stimuli, it responds well. If you show it half a face, or if you take a picture of a face and then move around the eye so it's down here and the mouth so it's up here and so on, if you jumble it up, then it doesn't respond very well. I don't think anybody knows. It's a good question. I think someone at Charlie Gross's lab actually tried to look at IT in very young monkeys, but I'm not really sure what it might be. The answer might be in the literature, but you know, for very young animals, it's going to be hard to record from. A little bit harder. They're smaller and so on. But I'm not sure. It's a very good question. So, of course, you're getting back to a very deep question here, which is nature versus nurture, right? Is the visual system somehow pre-specified in the genome? Or is it somehow learned from experience, right? So that's a very, very good question. I don't think anybody, babies have sensitivity to faces from a very young age, right? So it's not really clear what the answer is. All right, so Larry yesterday tried to explain, take these network models and explain simple cell orientation selectivity and complex cell insensitivity, invariance to phase. And I think so first of all, I have to say that you guys should understand that those models that he showed are by no means accepted as the models for how these things actually happen in the brain. Right? Nobody really knows the answer as to how these properties of selectivity and invariance really arise. I think Larry showed these models. The verdict is not yet in, but he tried to show these models as to illustrate general principles that we hope we're learning about the way recurrent networks operate. But I'm trying to give you some appreciation of the general issues, because I think you might ask, well, why should we spend so much energy on understanding simple and complex cells? Seems kind of boring. How is that going to take us all the way to understanding how vision really works? And that's why I'm bringing up the selectivity and variance issue as a general kind of issue. All right. Let me maybe just show you some more demos, just for fun. Let's see. All right, so you might ask, well, how can we extend this idea of simple and complex cells, but actually build a model which actually recognizes more complex things than just bars? And so on, maybe not faces, but something simpler. This was an artificial neural network constructed by a group at the old AT&T Bell Laboratories. This is called Linet, named after one of its creators, Jan LeCun. And it's a simple, very simple in its architecture in some sense, neural network model. I'll explain some of the details in a bit. But this network was trained to recognize hand-printed digits. And so you can see here that it's being fed some string of digits across here, and it's trying to do recognition at the top. What you're seeing on the left is the activities in the neurons in the various layers of the network. All right, here's the actual architecture of a network, or maybe not exactly that network, but it's similar, similar to that network. So there's an input layer, and then there's all these intermediate layers like this, and then finally at the output there's 10 artificial neurons, and they, you know, ideally, if the digit 5 is presented to the input, then neuron number 5 is active and all the rest of the neurons are not. This, what's that? Okay, so these boxes are, the idea then is that there's a bunch of, so there's a 32 by 32 input, kind of like the retina, and then there's a bunch of 28 by 28 arrays of neurons. Each neuron in this 28 by 28 array is looking at a 5 by 5 spot. That's kind of its receptive field on the retina. All right, and so this graphical representation is used because the network is constrained so that every neuron in this 28 by 28 array looks for exactly the same feature in the input. So its synaptic connections from this patch to here are exactly the same as the synaptic connections from this patch to here. Yeah, so the point is then, they're all these neurons are looking for one feature, and then all these neurons are looking for another feature, and so on. So there's 6 features that are being scanned for all over the image. Then these are called feature maps. These feature maps get downsampled to a 14 by 14 array of neurons. And so what's happening here is that each neuron is just looking at a 2x2 patch right here. And this was kind of biologically inspired. So the idea is then that these are something like simple cells, right? And these are complex cells. These cells are throwing away some positional information because they just sum up the activities of all. If any of these neurons are activated in this 2x2 patch, this neuron gets activated right here. And the same game is played here. These neurons are looking for features here, and then they're downsampled again. So this would be like another, you know, selectivity invariance, here and so on. Now, this network was not designed by hand. I mean, some of the constraints were put in by hand, but a learning algorithm called backpropagation, which I might tell you about later, was actually used to adjust the synaptic weights. So there's an element which is done by hand, which is to design the overall architecture and some constraints. But then some iterative algorithm is used to learn the synaptic weights from a set of examples. All right, so the basic strategy, of course, then is, so this is there's some biological inspiration here. If you look, you could take this network and you could probe it as a neurophysiologist, right? You could just not know, have any idea of how it works, just present it with images, bars or whatever, and try to measure the impulses or measure the signals from one of these artificial neurons and see what that artificial neuron responds to. And in fact, just by training it, it turns out that these, let's go back. So these are the actual first layer. I showed you that first layer of feature maps. And it turns out that these are basically looking for, these are all orientation selective neurons. So those six maps are basically looking for six different orientations in the image. The basic approach in this kind of network is that the receptive fields are getting larger and larger. So if I look at a neuron in one of the higher levels, if I trace back the neurons it's connected to in the retina, that's a larger area. So receptive fields are getting larger and larger. That's what happens in, of course, the real visual system. There's becoming more and more complex feature selectivity. So we have selectivity to bars or edges down here, but more complex things up here, right? So you can see that this is still a fairly simple topographic map, topographically organized. It's not really clear what this representation is. So at every stage, more and more complex feature selectivity and a greater degree of invariance. And it's pretty impressive. Here's translation. Scale. And so the idea is that each representation should become more and more invariant as you get higher and higher in the network. Yeah, these are fun. Okay, can we cover that up for a while? All right, so that architecture is called a multi-layer perceptron. And roughly speaking, neurons are arranged in layers. Like this. And there are synaptic connections. Going like this and so on. So this is the so-called feed-forward network. There are no feedback loops. There's just one directional flow of information like this, and all the synapses are oriented in that direction. And in fact, this is the way, classically, I think Larry mentioned the Hubel and Wiesel model. Of a simple cell, that's a so-called feed-forward model of how orientation selectivity arises. The basic idea being that if I took imagine that I took three center surround cells like this. And they've got some, I'm just drawing the on center right here. and they've got these inhibitory surrounds like this, and I hook them all up to another cell right here, and made this cell so that it would only trigger when it got a lot of input, so that all of these three cells had to be activated in order to make this cell fire, then I would have an orientation selective cell. Right? It would like to have light here, and it would like to have dark out here, because there are these inhibitory surrounds like this. And there would be much more response from a light bar like this than from a bar like this, because a bar like this can actually stimulate all three of these center surround cells, whereas a bar like this can only stimulate one of them at a time. And if I adjust the threshold of the cell to be high enough, then there'll be no response at all from the bar going like this. And remember their model. So this was a simple cell model. And their model of a complex cell would simply be to take another simple cell, which was connected to center cells, on-center cells right here, another simple cell which is connected to on-center cells right here, and put all those three simple cells together, hook them up to another complex cell, hook them up to another cell, which would be a complex cell, and it would respond to a bar anywhere along here like this. So, that's basically a feed-forward model of the brain. You just get selectivity by having a high threshold, so that only all three of these neurons, this is kind of like an AND operation, right? All these three neurons have to be stimulated in order for this neuron to get stimulated. Right? Whereas the complex cell will be more like an OR. Right? We hook it up to a bunch of simple cells with their on regions right here. If any of those simple cells is activated, then the complex cell goes off. So that's how you get selectivity and invariance. And so the artificial network I showed you is really, you could view as the elaboration of that idea in the engineering domain. Right? We just have all these operations which are achieving selectivity and invariance that way. Now the trouble is, if you look at the connectivity of the brain, it doesn't look anything like this. Right? So that's why, although the Hubel-Reisel model is probably correct to some extent, it's probably basically correct, it can't be the full story, because the connectivity of the brain is not feed-forward. There are all kinds of feedback loops. So there are estimates. Remember, if we go from retina to LGN to V1, if you look, believe in this Hubel-Reisel model of simple cells, then it should be, remember, these are the center surround cells, it should be this synaptic connectivity from LGN to V1. Which is responsible for giving rise to orientation selectivity. But if you look at neurons in V1, they receive only a very small fraction of their inputs from these synaptic connections. Most of their synaptic connections come from neurons that are also in V1. Right? So you can think about that if we said this was LGN. This is V1. This is obviously a gross caricature. There's all these kinds of lateral connections, like this. So what are all these lateral connections for? Right? And even worse, the estimates are that there's 10 times more connections from V1 back to LGN than there are forward. All right, so we've got all these connections that are going backwards. And that's a general rule. If you look at all these cortical areas beyond V1 and so forth, there are always projections going back, top-down projections. So nobody really has a good idea of what these are supposed to be doing. All right, so that's a fundamental mystery in neuroscience. And so what Larry tried to talk about yesterday was taking the Hubel-Reisel model and adding lateral connections, right? Adding these feedback loops, and trying to see how the feedback loops might contribute to something like orientation selectivity or something like invariance to phase. Yeah? I don't know so it depends actually on the animal, right? I guess in cats, LGN is directly connected to V2 also. So I would imagine it goes backwards. Yeah. There's species differences. Okay, so it's a complex issue, and what I'm going to tell you about, what I'm going to talk about today. So what Larry talked about was very controversial. I'm going to go back and talk about center surround organization because it's a little bit boring compared to orientation selectivity. Mm-hmm. But here things are on a little bit more solid ground. We have a little bit better understanding as to how these lateral connections might contribute to center surround organization. This has been studied in the vertebrate retina, right? But I have to say, even in the vertebrate retina, there's still some argument about how it happens. So I'm going to go to an invertebrate species, the horseshoe crab. If you look at classic experiments by Hartline and Ratliff, they elucidated how center surround organization really happens by lateral inhibitory connections. So remember that Larry focused a lot on excitatory feedback. But here we're going to talk about a network that just has, in which the lateral connections are purely inhibitory. So I'm going to need that again. Okay, so unfortunately, I don't have a slide of the actual horseshoe crab. I don't know if people have seen it, but it's not really, it doesn't look like your regular crab. It's got this kind of circular body and then a long tail sticking out of it like this. And it's got a compound eye. It's something like very much like an insect eye. The eye might be about 1 centimeter in diameter in adults. And it's composed of many tiny eyelets. They're called ommatidia, roughly 1,000 ommatidia. And each of these ommatidia actually has a lens. So there's many little lenses. and so you can, if you, there's a so-called pseudopupil right here. If you actually look into the eye, the ommatidia that are actually lined up in your direction, these are all sort of splayed out, surveying different directions. The ones that are lined up in your direction, you can see into the best and see the black pigmented photoreceptors at the back. And here's a cross-section showing just a few of the ommatidia. This front part right here is the lens, and the neurons, the receptors are actually back here. So they're something like 100 micron diameter, and each one is surveying, say, 5 to 10 degrees of visual angle. This is showing you now a cartoon of the ommatidium, a drawing of the ommatidium. The top is where that lens was. I'm only showing you the signal transduction part of the ommatidium. There are a bunch of cells that are actually at the back. I think something like 12 retinular cells, which are not the output. Well, their axons cannot be measured from in the optic nerve. Each ommatidium has one eccentric cell, or bipolar cell, and that's the output neuron that can be measured from in the optic nerve. All right, so this is just a picture to show you the anatomical substrate of lateral inhibition. So you can see out of the ommatidia, there are these axons that are emerging, and they're coming out in this optic nerve right here. They're converging, but they also send out collaterals, and so you can see that there's this sideways branching, and so that sideways branching is the source of the inhibitory connections, the lateral inhibitory connections between ommatidia, and that interaction is known to be purely inhibitory. And this is an extracellular recording from one of these ommatidia. These tick marks right here are every 200 milliseconds. And this is the intensity of illumination. You can see there's a roughly logarithmic encoding of intensity with the firing rate for one of these omatidia. Right, so this is the onset of a light pulse, and you can see there's some kind of adaptation that's very common in the nervous system, right? There'll be a fast response to a step will be large at first, there'll be a transient, and then it comes back down to a lower level of firing. There's not a lot of variability, it's pretty clock-like. All right, so one of the nice things about this preparation was that Hartline and Ratliff were actually able to control the stimulation of these receptors to a very high degree. They could actually take a fiber optic and they could stick it next to just one of these omatidia and stimulate one omatidium individually. And then they could investigate the interactions by stimulating more of these omatidia. So this is just showing the phenomenon of inhibition from the neighbors. The bottom trace shows the action potential recorded when a single omatidium was illuminated without any illumination on its neighbors. And in these top two traces, this black line marks the point where illumination of the neighbors commences. And so you can see that the illumination actually has a transient too. It's stronger at the beginning. There's no action potentials at all. And then it levels off to some, so the rate of this neuron levels off at some value that is lower than before the neighbors were actually illuminated. Right? So illumination of the neighbors is causing a reduction in the firing rate of the omatidium that's being measured from. So that's evidence of this lateral inhibitory interaction. And you can see the time scale here. It's pretty slow. It takes some time before the inhibition actually kicks in. So 100 milliseconds, 200 milliseconds. The only difference here is in the intensity of the illumination. So stronger illumination of the neighbors causes more of a drop in the rate. All right, this is a nice experiment. It's just illumination of two neighboring omatidia. So you can forget about the whole rest of the retina. Just consider this pair of receptors. And illumination of receptor A alone gave 53 impulses during this time period. Illumination of B alone gave 46 impulses during this time period. But if you illuminate A and B with the same amount, by the same amount, you get a decrement, 43 and 35 impulses. So they're actually inhibiting each other's discharge. All right, and that's good evidence of nonlinearity, right? If this were a linear system, then we should just get 53 and 46 right here. Now this is a quantitative plot of the effects of the inhibition. What's graphed? So the idea here is that on the x-axis, you vary. So what you're going to do is you take receptor A, you measure from receptor B, and you illuminate receptor A, and you see how much the illumination of receptor A decreases the impulses measured in B, and vice versa. So here is the number of impulses in receptor A. That's changing 10, 20, and 30 because we can actually change the illumination of receptor A. And what's graphed here is the reduction in the frequency of firing of receptor B. All right, so I'm... Right, I just...
It's very regular.
Yeah.
Is that because of the way this preparation is set up, or in the whole animal?
I don't know about the rest of the animal, but I do know that even in vertebrates, if you look in the sensory periphery, you can find cells that will fire much more regularly than in cortex. In cortex, you see all this kind of Poisson-looking noise, but you say look at a motor neuron at the motor periphery or at the sensory periphery, you can often see fairly regular firing. It's not completely true. Like, I guess in retinal ganglion cells, there's quite a bit of noise. But the general rule is that closer to the periphery, things tend to be more regular than centrally. I don't know what would happen. People haven't really studied other parts of this crab's brain. They really study the retina. It's a very easy preparation. All right, so let me just try to bring home what this was, right? So the way that plot was made is the x-axis, imagine that we take receptor A, it's been decremented by 10 impulses when receptor B is firing at 35 impulses. So that would be, if that were graphed here, that would be 10 for fiber, sorry, on fiber A, it would be 10 on the y-axis and 35 on the x-axis, right? So you vary the illumination of B, and then the decrement in A will vary. Vary the illumination of A, the decrement in B will vary. So that's just to show that the effect of inhibition is roughly linear. Right? If you increase the firing of A, the effect on B, the inhibitory effect on B, increases roughly linearly with the firing of A. Now, it happens that there's a threshold. So if fiber A is firing very slowly, then it has almost no effect on fiber B. But above that threshold, things behave roughly linearly. Okay, so here's another experiment which shows the variability of gain. This is, again, another illustration. So there's, on the one hand, I showed you some linear behavior. It's a kind of a paradox. I'm showing you linear behavior, but I'm also showing you nonlinear behavior. So this is nonlinear. Why? Well, if you eliminate one receptor, then the frequency of the firing rate of that receptor goes up like this. But now if you widen your spot of light so that 40 receptors are stimulated at once, then the response from this this receptor that you're measuring from goes up with a smaller slope. Right? In a linear system, it wouldn't matter. Right? Did I just make a mistake? Sorry.
I think I'm a little bit confused. When you say linear, I mean this effect could also be a linear effect. It's just a linear cross coupling between the inhibitory cross coupling. The nonlinear part is in the threshold.
Yep. Wait. All right. I shouldn't jump to conclusion. I shouldn't say that this is nonlinear. So, let's go back actually. Okay, do we agree this is nonlinear? Superposition fails, right? So A is being illuminated by a spot and B is not. B is being illuminated by a spot, A is not. And here we illuminate A and B with the same spots. So I should just get the summation of 046 and 530, but I don't. So that's clearly nonlinear. All right, this basically is showing you that there is a threshold nonlinearity, and of course that's the basic answer, that you can account for a lot of these effects by threshold nonlinearity. All right, so I should be cautious here. I'm not sure I want to say that this is nonlinear, but the point being that if I illuminate a large number of receptors, the gain seems to be smaller than if I illuminate just one receptor. All right, so let's... you mean microscopic explanation or... Okay, so there's... I'm going to give you some equations at this point, but there's... You're asking me what effect... Can I use this nonlinearity here to explain those responses, or can I explain why this nonlinearity exists in the first place? Which question are you asking? I mean, why would this threshold exist at all?
No, because probably many factors in the game. I mean, you know, function for neurons. And these two important factors, which can change in nonlinear way. But nonlinear sometimes does the function on every neuron, principle.
Yep.
So you can you have a game of these factors together with this, you have two receptors cells.
Right.
So
well, okay, so I'm going to show you a simple mathematical model that accounts for a lot of these results just using threshold nonlinearity. Now, you might ask, I don't know if you're asking biophysically, mechanistically, why, where does this come from? Is that what you're interested in, or the functional effect of this? I'm not sure. I'll just go on and give you the simple model. So we'll do the mutually inhibitory pair, and basically what Hartline and Ratliff said was the following. So this function I'm writing right now is equal to the max of x and 0, right? Or it's equal to x for x greater than 0 and equal to 0 for x less or equal to 0. So it just looks like this. So E1 would be the actual feed forward input. So some logarithmic function of the illumination intensity. And the rate is equal to that input minus the effect of inhibition from the neighbor. So this right here captures that threshold nonlinearity. We take R2, only if R2 is above some threshold, R2 comma 0, does it actually start contributing to the inhibition. And K12 is the strength. So remember I showed you that picture of the effect of inhibition. There's a slope and there's an intercept. So the intercept would be this R20 and the slope would be this K12 like this. So that's the rough model that they started out with. It's pretty much linear. Except that there's these extra rectifications. So it's a piecewise linear model. All right, so what I'm going to do is actually simplify it still further. To a first approximation, it's easier to lose these thresholds. And I'm going to assume that K12 and K21 are symmetric. In reality, they're not. The inhibitory effect on in one direction and the other direction is not exactly the same. So let's just write R1 equals E1 All right, so we can see a number of things here. First of all, if I stimulate only one receptor, then I'll get I'll get R1 is equal to E1, or R2 equals E2. So if I define the gain as the ratio of R1 and E1, then I would get a gain of 1. Now suppose instead I illuminated both receptors with the same value. So I just took E1 and E2 and set them equal to E. And clearly there's a symmetric solution where R1 is equal to R2. So in that case, so stimulate both receptors. I will get R2, well, I'll just get R is equal to E minus beta R. And if I solve that, I end up with R is equal to E times 1 plus beta. So my gain has gone from 1 to 1 over 1 plus beta. And so you saw there, remember that this is like your first hint that there's some validity to this model, right? You saw that if we stimulate more receptors, then the gain goes down. And that's what's happening here. If we stimulate two receptors, the gain is smaller than if we stimulate just one. All right, now you might ask, what happens if I, what happens in the arbitrary case? Well, in the arbitrary case we can solve, clearly it's pretty trivial. You just divide it up. There's really only three cases, right? So there's three cases. So let's do case one. Case one would be R1 and R2 are both greater than 0. If R1 and R2 are both greater than 0, then this network is operating in a purely linear regime, because that means that the arguments inside those rectifications have to be positive. Right? So I can just forget those things, those nonlinearities. Right? And I can solve this. I can solve this equation easily by just adding it together. If I add it together, I get R1 plus R2 is equal to E1 plus E2 minus beta times R1 plus R2. And so I solve and I find the following, which is simply the same as this relationship over here. And I can also subtract these two equations. And what I end up with is this equation. All right, and this is a very simple example of what Larry showed you yesterday. Remember, he said that if you take a linear network, then the linear network tends to either amplify or attenuate its inputs. And the amplification attenuation should be analyzed in terms of eigenvectors and eigenvalues. This network has a matrix, which looks like this. Right? There's this off-diagonal inhibitory term, and there's no self-interaction. And if you diagonalize this matrix, you'll end up with the 1-1 eigenvector and the 1-1 eigenvector. And the eigenvalues are going to be plus and minus beta. So remember, he gave you that general expression that the amplification gain is 1 over 1 minus lambda, where lambda is the eigenvalue. So that's happening here. This is called the common mode in engineering terminology. And this is the differential mode. In the case of the common mode, the gain is reduced from 1. In the case of the differential mode, the gain is actually increased from 1. So the differential mode is amplified and the common mode is attenuated. Sounds like it's a fancy way of saying it. It's useful language, though, I think. All right. So it makes sense, right? Lateral inhibition, at least to a first approximation, should reduce the response to the overall level of illumination, but it should enhance differences. And that's all we're seeing right here. So, and it makes sense, right? This is something very basic in vision. To a first approximation, we don't care what the overall illumination of the room is. We want it to, our visual system needs to detect differences. And that's why you can, that's why lateral inhibition is such an important thing in vision. All right, one additional thing I want to say, which is that it's kind of a trivial point, but this is the case of negative feedback. Remember, negative feedback reduces gain, and positive feedback increases gain. Right? And in a network, purely negative interactions, purely negative, purely inhibition can lead to both positive feedback and negative feedback. So the sign of feedback is not directly related to the sign of interactions. It's a very basic thing. It's just, you know, it has to do with eigenvalues and eigenvectors, right? I mean, the sign of an eigenvalue is not trivially related to the signs of the elements that are in the matrix. It's a very complex relationship. So this is negative feedback. And this is positive feedback. And it's obvious point, right? Positive feedback is because two inhibitions make for an excitation. That's something like that. Two inhibitions can act like an excitation. And I'll show you an example of that later on in the experiments. All right, so that's one possible case. We actually have to go back to check that this is self-consistent. We have to derive conditions so we can solve this linear system, and we have to go back once we can add these up together, right? And we have to verify that R1 and R2 are actually both greater than zero. Then this will be a self-consistent solution. So I'll leave it as an exercise to you. What are the conditions on R1 and R2 such that this solution is self-consistent? All right, you can figure it out later on. And then the other solutions are trivial, right? If one of R1 or R2 is zero, then we simply get back to the solution right here. So the only slightly non-trivial thing is to figure out what's the domain in which this solution is self-consistent. All right, and if we had actually, we could generalize this model clearly to K neurons. In that case, the gain of the common mode would have a factor of something like K or K minus 1 right here. So the more receptors I illuminate, the more the gain of this response is going to drop. And that's something that they did observe. Could I have that again? Oh yeah, you can see here, so this is 40 receptors versus 1, and the gain has dropped by roughly a factor of 2. So judging by that, if I told you that the attenuation in gain was 1 over something like 1 over 1 plus beta times k minus 1, or if k is large, it's just 1 over k times beta, and k is 40, then we would expect that beta is something like 1 over 20, or something on that order. And indeed, if you directly measure the interaction strength, you'll find something like 0.1, 0.05 as the interaction strength. So the numbers are roughly consistent. Another example of nonlinear summation, maybe I'm belaboring the point, but this X right here marks the omatidium that Hartline and Ratliff measured from. And then they illuminated these three spots. So here they illuminated this spot, here they illuminated this spot, and so on. And they measured this number right here is the decrement in the number of impulses measured from this omatidium in an 8-second time period. So here's what happens when they combine the illumination of this spot and this spot. Right? So the decrement is roughly by 40. And 40 is roughly the sum of this. And the same thing happens if they decrement, if they stimulate this spot and this spot, you know, roughly the same as adding up 22 and 23. The decrement in impulses is 42. And that's because these two spots and these two spots are far enough apart that they don't really interact directly with each other. They both have an effect on this spot, but they don't have much inhibitory effect on each other. But when two of these nearby spots are illuminated, you can see that the effect, the decrement is only 35. Right? And the reason, of course, is that these two are actually inhibiting each other, and so their rates become lowered, and then they have less effect, actually, on this neuron right here. So that's actually showing you the difference between what they called recurrent inhibition and feed-forward inhibition. You could have imagined that inhibition happened directly by... remember, I have this model right here. I have one layer. I have an input layer, and then the next layer like this. You can imagine I have a center surround structure emerging from direct excitation like this, and then lateral inhibition going in a feed-forward fashion like this. But this is just to show you, actually, that inhibition is really lateral. It's not going forwards. All right, this is just to make graphic the concept that two inhibitions can make something that looks like excitation. So the impulses in receptor A were being measured, right? And in the bottom trace right here, receptor C, or actually area C, composed of many receptors, is illuminated during this time period right here. And the frequency of firing of A is not affected. And that's because there's no direct inhibitory interaction between C and A. They're too far apart in the retina. Now, a different game is played. Before C is turned on, B is also illuminated. And here, the firing rate of B is shown. Discharge of B is shown, and the discharge of A is shown. And because B is being illuminated and it has an inhibitory interaction with A, you can see that A is at a lower rate than it was in this situation. But now when we turn on C, the rate of B goes down because C inhibits B. And because B was inhibiting A, when the rate of B goes down, the rate of A goes up. All right, so that's called disinhibition. That's what the physiologists like to call disinhibition. The inhibition was inhibited. All right, and so that's clearly again showing that the lateral inhibition happens after the nonlinearity, and not before. So you can see these experiments are very beautiful. Maybe. I guess Hartline and Ratliff did get the Nobel Prize for this, right? So it was done already starting back, I think, in the 30s and continued throughout the 50s. So, this is really the same point. I don't want to belabor this. And here's their diagram where they actually show, well, if I take, they show that they can model all interactions between three spots on the retina by choosing these interaction strengths and these thresholds like this. And so they have some threshold linear model, and this is the number of impulses that their threshold linear model would predict, and this is the number of impulses that they actually observe, and you can see that there's pretty good agreement between them. All right, this is just a picture to show you the distance dependence. The strength of inhibition is not actually the greatest for almatidia that are exactly neighboring each other, but it peaks a few almatidia away. And then it falls off, as you can see, with 5 or 10 kind of almatidia spacing. Now, I'm not really going to talk a lot about the the transient behavior of these. So I just told you about statics, right? I gave you these equations that were really kind of like algebraic equations. I didn't give you any dynamics. But we could put in, remember how in the neural network equations, we can actually put in this extra dx dt or dr dt term and actually model transient responses. This is the response to a step change. So the illumination, it's just dark, and then a light is turned on in a step change, and you can see that there's a transient like this. And then thereafter, there's some asymptote to a steady state. I guess the question is whether... This is actually very curious. It's known that this is a very common theme in the nervous system, right? You put on a step, the nervous system likes transients, so there'll be a very strong transient response to that change, and then there'll be some settling down. Larry talked about spike frequency adaptation, that some neurons intrinsically do that just by virtue of their intrinsic currents. They actually do, if you put in a step of current from the outside, the firing rate will do something like this. It turns out in Limulus, there's actually a self-inhibition, which I didn't talk about yet. So I lied when I said that these were zero. It turns out there actually is a self-inhibitory term that comes back. It's with a different time scale than the lateral inhibitory turns, but there really appears to be a chemical synapse which causes a self-inhibition. Intracellular recordings have verified that. And so that self-inhibition can actually account for this behavior. And so let me try to just describe that briefly, because it's a nice example of negative feedback. It turns out many of these examples of adaptation are negative feedback in some form or another. Now, there should be some rectification nonlinearity, some threshold nonlinearity here, but I'm going to leave it out because this is basically a linear-looking phenomenon. Nothing is going below threshold. So imagine that E is a step, right? What behavior will I get out of X? Well, it's pretty obvious. If this is just a low-pass filter, I can move this beta X over to the left, right? And what I'll get out of, so here's E as a function of time. Then here's X as a function of time. And this level right here, there's some attenuation due to the negative feedback, right? I'll get, as a steady state value, I'll get something like, if this were 1, here I would get 1 over 1 plus beta. Okay, so this is actually an embarrassment, right? Because X is supposed to be firing rate. And this doesn't look at all like what I showed you in that figure. What I showed you in the figure was this. So how do we solve this problem? All right, so this is really the problematic thing about these neural network equations that remember how Larry went into a whole, he spent a long time trying to tell you how can we go from a spiking model to these rate models. And the fact that he spent a long time on it means that the interpretation of these rate models is very problematic. It's difficult. You can make a lot of errors in getting it right, what these rate models are. But before I give you any justification, let's try something else. And I'll just tell you that let's interpret this as the rate. Right? If we interpret this as the rate, then what we got to do is we got to subtract, take this, and subtract off beta x. And if we take that and subtract off this increasing transient, increasing exponential right here, we will indeed get something that looks like this. If you put in a delay, you can get more kind of damped oscillations. Yeah, depending on what the delay is. But okay. So if you go back and look at what Larry talked about, right. So he wrote down some set of equations, which would be something like. These were the general, well, one general form for network equations. There are wasn't there for Larry's whole discussion, so I don't know exactly how he justified rate models. But there are some interpretations of rate models in which this nonlinearity right here is a relationship between current on the inside and firing rate. So think of the neuron as an input-output device. If we inject some current into it, we get out a firing rate. All right. And this f right here, is this nonlinear function f, is supposed to be that transduction function. It's supposed to be some kind of summarizing the input-output properties of that neuron. And so in that case, the interpretation is that these are currents, and then f is going to be something like a rate. And so we really have to take the right-hand side. The currents are low-pass filtered versions. So think about it like this. If I x is like the inhibitory current, right, coming from the self-inhibition, the self-feedback, it takes some time for the inhibitory current to turn on. You can think about the synapse as a low-pass filter of all this, of the spike train that's coming in. So the inhibitory current takes some time to turn on. And that delay right there is seen in the delay in some time lag in which negative feedback actually turns on and reduces the asymptotic value of the rate. OK, we should take a break. So actually, before we take a break, all right, we'll take a break now. We'll take a break. So you could think about a little bit about what Larry said yesterday and try to think about what the proper interpretation of these firing rate models is. All right, so I just realized that this issue of spiking and rate models is still pretty confusing. So I think I'll talk about that a little bit. Let's just write down the simplest possible, a very simple spiking network model. So I'll start with the integrate and fire model neuron. And that's going to look something like this. Okay, so remember the voltage of neuron I obeys the simple, if you just look at this term, a simple passive differential equation, low-pass filtered equation, right? V gets integrated. There's some membrane time constant due to the capacitance and the conductance due to the leak. There's some leak battery right here, right? And to that, we're going to add synapses. There's a synaptic conductance, G synaptic of neuron I, and it's driven by some synaptic battery. I think David talked about all this in the first day, right? So roughly speaking, if we wanted to simulate this, we would just integrate this differential equation. Whenever V reaches a threshold, we say there's a spike, and then we reset down to some new level and keep on doing that and so on. Now, what about a model of the synapse? Well, so here's this neuron, and it's got a bunch of dendrites and some axon coming out. So what's happening to the synaptic variables? So let's say we have some postsynaptic terminal right here, onto some spine. I'm going to make a simple approximation, and I'll say the following. So let's call Sij the fraction of the synaptic receptors that have some neurotransmitter bound to them. And that fraction can be anywhere between 0 and 1. All right? And so every time the neurotransmitter binds, then we have this forward reaction, Sij. And every time it falls off, we have the backward reaction where the channel closes. So here the channel is open, and it conducts, and here the channel is closed. And I have some forward reaction alpha and some backward reaction rate beta. But I have gating also. So the forward reaction only happens when there's neurotransmitter at this synapse, at the presynaptic terminal, when neurotransmitter gets released. So only when there's a spike in the presynaptic neuron can this forward reaction happen. So I'll put in an extra factor, which is delta of T minus T spike. So normally the forward reaction rate is 0, but whenever there's a spike happening, then I'll actually get some forward reaction like this. In reality, I might not want to put delta T minus T spike. I might want to smear it out a little bit because the neurotransmitter might be in the cleft for some longer period of time. But this is just a nice approximation. Make that instantaneous. So the expression then for this, the synaptic variable would be so the forward rate constant, which is alpha times 1 minus Sij minus beta times Sij. So if there's no spike at all, this term vanishes, and Sij decays back to 0 with a time constant 1 over beta. And if there is a spike, then we have some increment happening like this. Okay, and oh, I should say T spike in, remember that the synapse from, this is going to be the synaptic variable. So the synapse from neuron J to neuron I, so it's driven by the spikes in neuron J. And finally, what I need is a conductance. I need an expression for this conductance right here. So that conductance would be equal to summation over J Wij Sij. So the total synaptic conductance in neuron I will be a weighted sum of these synaptic variables, Sij, which are all going into neuron I. So what is Wij? Wij would be the maximal conductance of synapse Ij, right? Sij is a variable from 0 to 1. If all the synaptic receptors are open, Sij equals 1, then they have a total conductance Wij. So this is maximal conductance. of all right, so these three equations are enough. You could do a numerical simulation of a simple network of integrating fire model neurons. Just integrate this equation. Every time there's a spike, you change Sij. So according to this equation, there's some ambiguity in the definition, but basically Sij, when there's a spike, goes to Sij plus alpha times 1 minus Sij. Right, so Sij gets incremented by that amount, and between spikes, Sij just decays. So if I drove this equation with a bunch of spikes, so let's say that the presynaptic neuron was doing this, then the postsynaptic neuron, the Sij in the synapse, would be doing something like this. Now, you can see now that the increment is going down as I put more spikes in, and that's because of saturation, right? I can't, according to this equation, I can't have Sij go above 1. And that's because the increment that each spike causes in Sij goes down as Sij gets closer and closer to 1. And everything is well-defined as long as alpha is less than 1. You can't possibly get above Sij equal to 1. So the numerical simulation is simple. Just first-order equations. And this goes back into, right, Sij gets summed up and goes back into G-synaptic and determines what this equation is doing. So just based on that, you could do a numerical simulation already. One of the simplest possible models. We can make this better. I mean, it is a very simplified model, right? This synaptic conductance has an infinitely sharp rise time and so on. There's some problems with it, but it's a first approximation. All right, so the question is, under what conditions can I take this model and approximate it as a rate model? When can I get rid of the spikes? Right? And Larry talked about one condition yesterday. Well, clearly what I got to do is I got to do some kind of averaging. And Larry talked about this mean field limit, where if I have many synapses coming into one neuron, all the spikes can somehow, all the spikes coming up from many, because there's many spikes from many different neurons, on average, the total synaptic conductance coming in is a non-fluctuating quantity. Right? So that was a large N kind of averaging going on. So today I want to talk about a different kind of averaging, which you can do an averaging in time. So Bart Ehrmantraut has a very nice paper on this. And so the argument is that if the time scale of the synaptic current becomes very long, then you can average in time. And the intuition is quite simple, right? Suppose that beta were very large, so that the decay was very fast, then my picture would look like this. Right? A synapse would only slightly filter the spike train that came into it. But if my synaptic variable is very slow, then the time constant of the low-pass filter that takes in this spike train right here is going to smooth out the profile. Right. So the spikes become irrelevant. Every neuron only listens to its neighboring neuron through the synaptic variable, and the synaptic variable is low-pass filtering the spike train with a very long time constant. So it makes some kind of sense that we ought to be able to get rid of the spikes altogether. Okay, so that's the approximation. So the method of averaging. Employs the tau goes to infinity limit, where tau is equal to, well, I should, I didn't actually do this. I got to be careful about the limit, so let's do it like this. Okay, so I'm really holding, so the idea is that you take tau to infinity, but hold alpha bar constant. And in that, it's a separation of time scales argument. Right. And it assumes that the spiking happens rapidly. That's the fast thing. And we can get rid of the fast thing and only keep the slow variables. So the argument then is that as tau goes to infinity, and I'm not really filling out all the details of the argument, but the rough argument is that I can replace this by rate. Of neuron J. Right, because the average if I took a spike train and so alpha, let's say alpha is a sum over all the spikes. Then this average is going to be equal to rate. Yep.
The distribution of the spikes has to be natural, but not correlated with the bosonic spectrum or everything. So we can make this average.
it's a good question. I think that as tau, in the limit as tau goes to infinity, I don't think you have to make any statements. Correct me if I'm wrong. I don't think you have to make any statements about correlation or not. Now, it's true that in finite tau, you might end up with some problems in the correlations, but as tau goes to infinity, nothing's going to happen. And another way of thinking about that, so what's happening with this? So what's happening when you do this is that you're taking this scaling is really reducing the height and increasing the time constant, so that the area under the synaptic conductance change stays constant. That's what this particular scaling is. So these jumps are going to become smaller and smaller and smaller. And these things will last longer and longer and longer. So this thing just really becomes smooth. That's the reason why. Now, rigorously speaking, if you want to do a proof of this, I think then the correlations do become a problem. Technically, it's very hard to prove this rigorously. For systems involving many neurons. But say a system involving one neuron fed back to itself, I think you might be able to do something rigorous. Right. So there's some hand-waving. Okay, so there's a question of what's true, and there's a question of what can be proven. So I think it's true that the correlations don't matter as tau goes to infinity. But we should ask, you guys should ask Bard when Bard comes. Bard will give a talk here, and maybe Bard can answer that question better than I can. That's right. That's right. Beta goes to zero with the scaling right here. All right, so we have this equation now. We've just replaced these delta functions by this rate right here. Right, and basically the idea is that I can average this over time, and the average of this just becomes 1 over the interval between spikes.
Excuse me?
Yep.
Did Iris say that you can't take an average over delta functions? As I remember, he wrote exactly that. You can't do
anything. All right. let's see. I'm being very sloppy here. Yeah. This is the time average. Gee, I should have let Bard do this whole thing. So typically what you do here is that you would average over... all right, I'm not going to try to make this more rigorous because I'm going to get stuck. I didn't... What's that?
Make them finite width.
Yeah, make them finite width. In reality, the synapse... In reality, the synapse is not a delta function anyway, right? So we could average it. All right. So the rate is going to come out this way. And let's see, one more step we have to do. Okay, so what is the rate? We need to close this equation. So somehow I need to relate this rate back to that integrating fire neuron back there. And so the way I can do that is I can take the integrating fire neuron, and I can imagine I did a numerical simulation of the integrating fire neuron. I could set G synaptic to be 1 and compute the firing rate of the integrating fire neuron. Set G synaptic equal to 2 and compute the firing rate and so on. Actually, you can do it analytically, but it doesn't matter. And what I end up with is something that looks like this. So here's rate, and here is G. And so let's call that relationship F of G. So then I'm done, because I can simply take that equation. Almost done. There's one more thing that I can do. You can notice that I can drop the index I. Right? If I look at all the Sij's with the same index I, if I look at all the Sij's with the same index j, but different indices I, they all have the same right-hand side. Right? They're all being driven by this quantity right here. Right? So let's just go back to this original equation. Already you can see it here. If I have a bunch of Sij's and I all drive them with the same spike train, then they're all going to do the same thing. Right? So this is a simplifying assumption. In reality, beta might depend on which synapse you're at, and alpha might depend on which synapse you're at also. But if we assume that alpha and beta are all the same, then we can actually drop the index I, because every synaptic variable is being driven by the same spike train and will respond in the same way. So if we do that, we end up with this equation. And substituting in this formula right there, and you can see that that's almost the same format as the neural network equations that Larry wrote. I just move this to the left-hand side. I divide by beta, and I end up with this equation. There's a difference. I have this 1 minus Sj here, which is to model the effects of synaptic saturation. If all the synapses are assumed to operate well below saturation, then we can get rid of this 1 minus Sj. This would be roughly 1. And I would have then exactly the kinds of rate equations that that Larry wrote. Now, let's just note here, though, that there's a particular biophysical interpretation of these equations that comes from the way in which we derive them. Right? So what is S according to this? S is not a rate. S is a synaptic variable. I like to call it synaptic activation. It says what fraction of the receptors at the synapse. Well, so Sj would be the synapses coming out. Remember, Sj is short for Sij. So that's all the synapses coming out of neuron J. So what fraction of receptors are open at synapses from neuron J? Then tau right here would be not a membrane time constant, but it would be the synaptic time constant. When ligand binds to a synaptic receptor, how long does it usually take before that ligand falls off and the receptor closes again? So this would be the time constant of postsynaptic conductance change. Alpha would be a measure of how large, what would be the peak value of a conductance change. Yeah, question. That's right.
While yesterday when there was the rate model versus the working model, the conductance comes very short.
That's right.
No.
What's the relation between?
Okay, yeah, David?
No, I think it was backwards. This is the same time constant in front of the currents, which is the short time constant, the time constant governing the current injected into the cell. It's not the time constant of the membrane.
Well,
the time constant is short.
No. So yesterday, Larry talked about the mean field, and he said that mean field, if you average over large n, right, then he can cope with a short time scale. And he likes that because he says, well, the time scale of AMPA is very fast, like a few milliseconds. However, mean field, of course, would still work if the time constant were long. It doesn't matter. Right? So mean field works, it uses large n, so it doesn't care what the time constant is. Now, all I'm saying here is that with this particular averaging method is only going to work for slow synapses. It's not going to work for a purely AMPA network. All right? And in this derivation, what did tau come from? Tau came from this kinetic model of a receptor.
But there's still a longer... It's true, but then there's still a longer time constant, which would be the membrane time constant.
No. Here we assume that the membrane time constant is shorter. So tau is long, and we assumed... So here we have a relationship. Remember, I derived this relationship. Didn't derive it, but we have to get this relationship between rate and conductance, G. And we get that by putting the conductance G inside this integrating fire model and seeing how fast it fires. Right? Now, to a change in G, it may take some time before the integrating fire model actually establishes that rate. And we're assuming that that's instantaneous because we've assumed that tau is long. All right. So my assumption then is that tau, of course, tau is never infinite in reality, right? We need to have tau quite a bit larger than the time scale of the intrinsic, the firing pattern, the actual potential generation. That's when this technique works. So if you started talking about, say, with excitatory synaptic currents, you know that there's several varieties of the glutamate receptor. One of them is AMPA, and that's fast. Another is NMDA. NMDA is fairly slow. It could be up to 100 milliseconds. So 100 milliseconds can be quite a bit longer than the time scales involved in membrane integration. So this starts to make some sense if you talk about slow synapses like NMDA synapses. All right. Then this right here is the relationship between rate and synaptic conductance. And this right here is this maximal conductance that I talked about. All right, so here's one particular limit. It's not totally applicable because, of course, there are fast synapses too. But it's just nice to see that there's another limit in which you don't need large n in order to get something that behaves like a rate model. All right, so let's go back then to the example I showed from Limulus. You have that? So you can see that in this case, this decay of the firing rate in response to a step is quite slow. It takes something like half a second to get down by 1 over E or something, maybe half a second, something like that. Here it is, tau equals 0.41 seconds. And in fact, when people directly measured synaptic currents in limulus photoreceptors, they found that the time constant of inhibition is pretty long. At least for the self-inhibition. I think the lateral inhibition is a bit faster, but for the self-inhibition, it's slow. So the method of averaging, I think, does make some sense for this particular case, right? If you were to simulate this with an integrate and fire neuron fed back to a cell, that's the whole point, which is that you put on the input like this. The neuron starts firing soon after in some fast time scale, right? Starts firing. Once the neuron fires, that inhibitory synapse starts to do this. It builds up like that. It takes some time for the inhibition, the S variable, to build up. Right? So, yeah. What's that? I'm not sure what the mechanism. I think in this, I'm not sure what the biophysical mechanism is that's known here, but. It's quite possible in this case, yeah, the ligand is taking is actually binding for half a second. It could be a second messenger thing. I'm not sure. I mean, I gave a kind of phenomenological model, but there are cases of synaptic currents which last for, I think, in the bullfrog sympathetic ganglion, I've seen traces of synaptic conductances that last for minutes. All right, so. There are this issue of timescales. The nervous system has many timescales built into its chemical signaling. So I don't know. Did you talk about the distinction between neurotransmitters, neuromodulators, and so on?
No.
Didn't we talk about that? So there are fast things that act over a few milliseconds, 10 milliseconds, something like that. There are slower things which act over seconds and minutes, and other things which act over many minutes. So. There's many different kinds of chemicals that the nervous system can use, and one way to break it down is in terms of the speed of action, or how long the action lasts. Yep.
So, biologically speaking, I guess this issue of time-scale separation ties into the issue of compartmentalization. So that if the fast synapses are in a very different location than the slow ones, then you can really deal with them separately. And then one place makes this approximation, another place makes that approximation. Is that valid?
No, I think generally they're all mixed up.
Yeah, I mean, it's
yeah.
The name of somebody's rule. It's generally sort of the case that on the presynaptic side, if a cell gives off a certain transmitter, it gives off the same.
Oh, well, Dale's Law.
Dale's Law.
Right.
And on the postsynaptic side, usually has the same mixture of receptors. So Like inhibition is a classic example. So straight to Dustin's point, there's fast inhibition, which is a few milliseconds, direct opening of a channel. There's slow inhibition, often with the same molecule.
Is anyone going to talk about ionotropic, metabotropic, and
right.
Is anyone going to talk about that? Maybe this afternoon.
Do it.
I haven't prepared. Okay. Well, maybe we should have some kind of talk about what the synapses are and what kind of rules people have found. But I just wanted to make the point that in this case, the synapse is acting pretty slowly. And so basically the inhibition, when the stimulus comes in, the spikes turn on, the inhibition takes some time to build up, right? S has got, imagine you were simulating this with an integrating fire model, you would have your S, and every time there was a spike, that S would get incremented by some amount and then start decaying again, increment and start decaying again. And so S would gradually build up, and therefore the strength of inhibition then would come and slow down the spike train like this. All right. So things are starting out fast, and the decay of the firing rate is equivalent then to the time that it takes for inhibition to build up. And that time is governed by the time constant tau in this particular model, and the right-hand side is the rate. So that's what I was trying to argue for you before, that this simple model of x dot is equal to something like this, x is really a synaptic variable. It's not rate. It's going up like that. And it's the right-hand side, which is the rate. And it takes time for the synaptic variable to respond to changes in rate, because the synapse is acting like a low-pass filter. That's all I was trying to say there before. OK. Let's go back to PowerPoint. Blank screen. That's not a good sign. There we go. All right, I should say that in other cases, you can actually see, just to wrap up the transient stuff, you can actually see ringing in the responses. So there'll be instead of just a simple exponential decay, there might be something that looks like this. And that can actually come from modeling. If you model the synapse as having a rise time, so in this model, right, I had a instantaneous rise time and then a fall rise. But you can model the synapse with two time constants, so it has a tau 1 and a tau 2. Then you end up with a second order thing on the left-hand side of your network equations, and you can get oscillations because that system has two time constants rather than one. All right, but let me just conclude with a little bit of fun. Does it work here? Let's see.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna. So, what do you guys? So clearly, what I have here is luminance varying as a function of horizontal position, right? So, if you had to draw a graph of the luminance profile, what would you guys say on the top? Sigmoid? Okay, so something like this. We're going to have to lead them a little bit. We're going to have to cheat. This is not a very good.
Extra dark and extra bright on the two sides of the sigmoid.
Okay, so it's not monotonic?
Not monotonic.
I planted her. Okay, so what you're supposed to see is a little overshoot here. And it doesn't look that good here. This display is not high contrast enough. But I think you can see a little band right there. All right. And so that's called the Mach bands. That's named after Mach. He's the same guy that Einstein had the correspondence with about if you turn the world around the bucket, would the water go up in the bucket, that kind of thing. So Mach also worried about these he discovered this interesting illusion. In reality, all I've done is the luminance there is really just this. It's just flat and then linear and then flat again. But you're actually seeing an extra band at the edges. And so what do you see here? What's the luminance profile here? So the real luminance profile is steps. But I think you should see that this looks lighter than that. This looks lighter than that. So it looks more like this, right? Something like that. And that's called Chevreul's illusion. So there's a great story about Chevreul. Chevreul was a textile merchant. He had a great thriving textile business, and he sold some tapestries to some rich customer. And the customer complained. He says, "There's some strange imperfections in your dyeing process. The colors are not even in your tapestry." So Chevreul was really distressed. You know, he prided himself as being the best tapestry dealer in France or whatever. And he did a lot of research. He tried to figure out, he looked for all these, any kind of imperfection that might exist in the dyeing process, and he finally concluded that it was a trick of the eyes. So actually, this is an optical illusion that he discovered. Okay, so I'm just showing you these examples of these lightness, of how our lightness computations are affected by context, because this is the first way in which the phenomenon of lateral inhibition was observed, right? And you can actually explain these in terms of the center surround structure. So if I take the true lightness profile and I convolve it with one of these linear filters that looks like a Mexican hat, then I will end up with an enhancement at the edges like this. All right. So let me try to put it a little bit less mathematically. So let's look at a neuron with a center surround structure. It's right here. Right? Well, it's receiving, okay, imagine a neuron with a center surround structure here first. It's receiving inhibition both from the right and the left. Equal amounts of inhibition from the right and the left. But a neuron that's sitting at this border, it receives less inhibition from the left than it does from the right. It's receiving less inhibition total, therefore its response is larger than the response of the neuron right here. And that's why that part should look brighter. Right? And it's the same kind of argument for the Mach band. Right? The neuron that is at the edge of the cliff, so the neuron that's right here at the edge of the cliff, it's not getting its inhibition, as much inhibition from the left as it is from the right. Whereas neurons that are far away from the cliff are getting a lot of inhibition both from the left and the right. So that's the standard accounting for this in terms of linear filter theory. And there's a great paper. So Ted Adelson is actually the master of lightness illusions, and you should look up his paper. It's available on the web. And he shows you beautiful, incredible lightness illusions. They've been used in art and so on. And a lot of them can be accounted for by center surround structure. And the functional explanation, of course, is that again, I told you about how the nervous system likes transients in time. The nervous system likes to see changes, enhanced changes, in space also. That's the standard explanation.
Does the inhibition occur only horizontally and not vertically?
Does it? I don't know. Not for me. Okay, so I just want to conclude, though, by telling you that not all lightness illusions can be accounted for by this local center surround explanation. So this is one due to Ted Adelson. And just compare the lightness of this check and that check. right? So they are actually the same. They don't look the same. Oh, they look the same. I don't know. What? Do you see?
I just don't believe.
What's that?
I just don't believe.
You don't believe it? What's that? What's that? Okay.
Supposing you mean part of the
Well, this was made in a drawing program, and that's supposed to be the same patches just taken out. I mean, we need to make an aperture and put it over, but. Well, I could if the screen were smaller, but it's kind of. Let's see. Make a hole. I have to make a hole, right? Yeah, it's a little hard, but you could find this. This is in his paper. If you can download it, I'll try to find the link, and you can get a smaller version. So this illusion is meant to argue that it's not just low-level information, you know, not just the neighboring dots which are influencing your perception of lightness, but all kinds of information that's non-local and even high-level, right? I mean, your high-level knowledge about what's a shadow and et cetera, these are going to influence your perception of what lightness actually is. Right? And why is that? Well, the nervous system clearly, well, I shouldn't say clearly, but so there's a naive realist kind of idea of a perception that your nervous system simply accurately reflects, vertically reflects what's there. But what's there is very hard. I talked about this problem of variability before, right? The problem with perception of lightness is that how much light you get from an object depends both on its intrinsic reflectance properties and on its illumination, right? And as an animal that wants to cope with a world and figure out what things are invariant, what I'd like to do is pull out the reflectance properties. The reflectance properties are intrinsic to the object. They're what tell me when an apple is red, right? I want the apple to look subjectively red, no matter what mixture of colored light is impinging on that apple. So that's the problem. It's really a very difficult mathematical problem because, in principle, we can put all kinds of strange illumination patterns on this, and yet we have to figure out what the reflectance map is. And the reason that this we're biased in, of course, is that our nervous system is figuring out that this truly is, you know, fundamentally in terms of reflectance, this is a light check and that's a dark check on the checkerboard. And that's biasing our judgment of what is light and what's not. Okay, so I'll just wrap it up here. We got the barbecue now then? Is that?
Well, I mean, technically about 25 minutes. You could go for a while.
That's enough. That's enough. Is that enough? I'll lecture longer in the afternoon.